This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 24th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Some 400,000 workers on strike in Brazil against a pay hike they say is an insult. World Bank bonds are banned in yet another city as Boulder, Colorado gives them the thumbs down. And a critical look at the media attention around the Gary Condon, Chandra Levy case. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Yugoslav government said they would allow NATO forces to move through their country on the way to Kosovo. The current government said they will put strict limits on NATO's so-called peacekeeping force and determine the exact points of entry and exit through their country. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade reports the troop movements mark a significant change in Yugoslavian policy.
NATO wanted to have free and unrestricted access throughout all the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia and to be able to move their troops and their ships and weapons through Yugoslavia to go down to Kosovo. And Milosevic said no. And, you know, that his rejection of Rambouillet was ultimately what they said caused the bombing. The position of the Yugoslav government was that these are demands that no sovereign country would accept.
Former Yugoslavian President Slobodan Milosevic is now in The Hague facing charges of crimes against humanity. Kosovo has been an international protectorate since NATO's 1999 bombing campaign. There are approximately 43,000 NATO soldiers in Kosovo. During a press conference where President Bush announced his recommendation for a new Joint Chiefs of Staff, he reiterated his position that the United States will not attend the UN's week-long conference against racism and why.
We have made it very clear through Colin Powell's office that we will have no representative there so long as they pick on Israel, so long as they continue to say Zionism is racism. That's if they use the forum as a way to isolate our friend and strong ally, we will not participate.
The week-long conference begins on August 31st in South Africa. Critics of the U.S. position say the importance of the conference is diminished without U.S. participation and that the U.S. does not take the issue of racism seriously. The British government says it will reintroduce controversial immigration controls at the Prague airport next week to reduce the number of Roma people, commonly referred to as gypsies, seeking asylum in that country. Free Speech Radio News' Charles Michael Ray has the story from Prague.
The British government says they are again imposing the travel restrictions to prevent what they see as abuse of the asylum system. After the lifting of the recent restrictions, a large number of Roma again began to travel to Britain. Sean Nazarelli, advisor to the president of the International Roma Union, says the British policy is discriminatory.
The key issue, though, is why do people here feel they need to leave? And the second issue that needs to be answered on the British side is how are we to deal with asylum seekers? If they're genuine asylum seekers, then they should have the right, under all international agreements, to apply for asylum and go through the immigration process, the asylum process. But to close the borders off from abroad is denying Roma their rights given under the Geneva Conventions to apply for asylum.
Nazarelli says Roma people seek asylum to escape widespread racial violence and discrimination in the Czech Republic. British officials say the Czech Republic is a safe country whose citizens have no reason to apply for asylum. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Prague.
An Idaho man has been released after 17 years on death row because DNA tests cast doubt on his murder conviction. Lee Robartis has more from Idaho.
Thank God for DNA were the words uttered by 52-year-old Charles Fain as he was released from a Boise penitentiary yesterday. Fain had been convicted of drowning and sexually assaulting 9-year-old Darylyn Johnson in 1982, but had always maintained his innocence. Judge B. Lynn Windmill said the fact that pubic hair found on the girl's body was not Fain's cast doubt on the conviction. Although Fain could still be retried at a future date, his defense attorneys doubt that will ever happen. Fain's case was one of the first in the nation to use mitochondrial DNA to determine whether a specimen came from a particular suspect. Because hair has no cell nucleus, normal DNA testing does not work. So scientists sampled mitochondria, a tiny organelle found outside the cell nucleus. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis.
And finally, the U.S. government is investigating claims that Johns Hopkins University studied lead poisoning in poor neighborhoods using methodology reminiscent of the infamous Tuskegee Institute study of syphilis in African-American men. Zach Badorf reports from D.C.
The Department of Health and Human Services Office for Human Research Protections is now investigating a Johns Hopkins study on the effects of lead paint on humans. The investigation centers around charges of negligence that the Kennedy Krieger Institute, in a 1990 study, did not warn the participants about the potential dangers of lead poisoning. By repairing and removing certain levels of lead paint in select rental housing units in Baltimore, the study planned to show how to effectively reduce lead in the blood of children. The Kennedy Krieger Institute claims that they did inform participants about the potential dangers of the lead poisoning when conducting the study. They claim the study was completed to find a way to reduce exposure to lead and resulted in a reduction of lead in all participants. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Zach Badorf.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Israeli forces thrust deep into a Palestinian-ruled area of the West Bank city of Hebron overnight, blowing up two houses. The Israeli military forces say the area attacked is a strategic rise from which Palestinian gunmen fire on Jewish settlements in the heart of the divided city. Raphael Kraft reports from Ramallah.
The Israeli army made the incursion overnight on the Abu Sneina Hill, a full Palestinian-controlled neighborhood of Hebron, destroying two houses and wounding 12 Palestinians. The raid was launched by Israeli border police and paratrooper units after Palestinians' resistance opened fire on Jewish settlers, wounding an 11-year-old boy. The Abu Sneina Hill dominates the old city of Hebron, almost entirely occupied by 400 of the most extremist Jewish settlers, protected by some 5,000 Israeli soldiers in the midst of 30,000 Palestinians. The Israeli troops withdrew from the hill after 3 hours. One of their soldiers was lightly wounded. It is the greatest Israeli incursion in a full Palestinian-controlled area since the start of the Second Intifada last September. This incursion is in the lineage of the new policy of the Israeli government, that is to invade for a short period of time full Palestinian-controlled territories. A similar incursion in the northern West Bank town of Jenin last week had been made by Israeli forces who demolished a Palestinian police station. Another similar raid on the Palestinian cities of Bethlehem and Beit Jala was cancelled in the last minute after Arafat ordered an end to the shootings on the Jewish settlement of Gilo, according to Israeli officials. The Israeli army said the operation in Hebron last night was meant to signal it could permanently occupy the area if shooting persisted. This incursion fragilizes the eventuality of a yet-to-be-scheduled meeting in between Yasser Arafat and Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres. After the Dolphinarium suicide bomb attack in Tel Aviv last June, Ariel Sharon went round the eventuality of a large-scale invasion of the Palestinian-controlled areas of the occupied territories. These types of flash incursions are seen by Palestinian observers as one of the steps prevailing a full-scale invasion of the autonomous Palestinian territories of the occupied West Bank and Gaza. This, according to them, would lead to a bloodshed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Ramallah.
It's day two of a strike by an estimated 400,000 federal workers in Brazil. Some two-thirds of Brazil's 600,000 federal civil servants are on strike against a 3.5% salary increase that is in line with inflation, but which the unions call an affront to the sector. The workers say President Henrique Cardoso is gutting public programs to pay off Brazil's massive foreign debt, which exceeds 50% of the country's gross domestic product. Joshua Chaffin reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Brazil's federal employees unions say the 3.5% raise announced this week is an insult, and they voted to stay on the picket lines indefinitely. Union rep for the university service workers in Rio, Simone Silva, says this strike has everything to do with Brazil's new accord with the International Monetary Fund, a loan that's intended to buffer Brazil from the economic crisis engulfing neighboring Argentina. The government is trying to pay all its internal debt as a condition of another loan it's getting from the IMF. But as far as we're concerned, the federal service workers, We haven't had a salary readjustment in 7 years. 7 years with the same salary. They promised us a meaningful raise last year, which we didn't get. But in contrast, the government is keeping all its promises to the IMS. Simone Silva and the university service workers joined more than 1,000 people in a march to the center of Rio on Wednesday. Their employees from various sectors of government met with students and retirees who are condemning President Fernando Henrique Cardoso and calling for greater funding for education and social services. Accurate totals are hard to get because the government agencies following the strike are staffed by union members, but hundreds of thousands of people on Brazil's federal payroll have reportedly agreed to a strike this week, including some 3,600 professors at the federal universities. Even as they disrupted traffic and chanted anti-government slogans, many of the marchers in Rio made the sign of the cross as they passed the cathedral. At the front of the pack, it was all kids, like 16-year-old Gabriel, who wore a T-shirt with the United States flag crossed out and the slogan, "We must resist." I'm here to fight for a raise for the federal employees, but I also want more money for the schools. The government has a responsibility to make things better for the students. We need a computer lab in my high school, a chemistry lab, a biology program, and a physics program. I can't get those things in my school. A man in his 40s who calls himself Newton is one of the employees of Brazil's social security system who's out on strike. Newton says the reason the schools and the service workers are not funded adequately is that Brazil's government is preoccupied with satisfying its free trade agreement. To put it simply, the IMF is taking away the power of the Brazilian people. They are buying votes in the parliament, making bankers rich, and leaving Brazilians to live in poverty. But Brazil is a country where massive work stoppages are common, and since the president is required by law to announce the federal wage increase every year on this day, August could fairly be called strike season. And not everyone is on the march. Eduardo is a well-dressed stock trader for one of Brazil's biggest banks. Taking a break from work to watch the marchers go by, Eduardo says he's happy with the salary he receives. It's a free country. People should be able to do what they want. They can have a strike if they want to. The different sectors of the economy have to look out for themselves. But it's true the federal employees haven't had a raise in a long time. Anticipating the controversy over the pay raise, Brazilian President Cardoso told the newspapers that even he is dissatisfied with his salary. President Cardoso says even the 3.5% raise was difficult to squeeze out of the federal budget in these troubled financial times. The federal workers' unions vowed to keep their 400,000 members on the picket lines until the government gives them a raise of 75%. But in a similar strike last year, unions agreed to go back to work on the promise of a 25% raise. That raise never materialized. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
Talks between the Democratic Republic of Congo's warring parties and other groups entered their final day, with all sides hailing the meeting as a trust-building exercise, which had reached agreement on a number of key issues. The talks, being held in the Botswana capital of Gaborone, are the first stage towards finding a lasting settlement to the three-year war, which has seen the country divided into areas controlled by several rebel groups and the Kinshasa government. But the talks are unlikely to bring an immediate peace or ceasefire agreement. Over the last decade, the Democratic Republic of Congo has suffered a series of political and economic crises. With at least seven countries involved militarily in the east of the country, much of the DRC has become an extended war zone. According to the International Crisis Group, more than 2.5 million people have died as a result of the conflict since 1998. Most of those deaths have been due to rampant disease or malnutrition. Rupert Cook reports from Kinshasa.
Congolese buy and sell in a market just outside the country's capital, Kinshasa. People haggle over monkey, antelope, and a range of exotic bushmeat. However, one of the reasons for the increased dependency on bushmeat has been the effect of the war and the consequent increased shortages of food. Despite the bustling atmosphere of the market, people in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, have, over the last few years, had to suffer a massive humanitarian cost, thanks to the long-running war in the east of the country. Besides the shortages of traditional meat sources, there has also been a collapse in the country's health system. Lennard Tapsoba is the World Health Organization's representative in Kinshasa.
Ooh, there are a lot of challenges. Really, in DRC, regarding the health situation, everything is a priority. There are a lot of challenges, primarily due to the political and socioeconomic situation since maybe 10 or more than 10 years. The war also came and contributed to destroy the rest of the health infrastructure. So the human resources, regarding human resources, a lot of medical doctors, nurses, and so on, have been obliged to quit the country for their own security. Regarding the health situation, some years ago, that country was one of the models in Africa. But unfortunately, due to mismanagement and due to the war, the situation is worse.
The ravages of war have had a considerable negative effect on the general health of the population in the DRC. Without peace, the prognosis looks bleak. Mashako Mamba is the DRC's Minister of Health.
Nous ne voulons pas la guerre, nous voulons la paix et le partenariat dans la sous-région.
We don't want the war. We want peace and partnership in this region. Peace is also a challenge for us because if there isn't peace, the struggle against AIDS will be more difficult for us, but also for everybody in the region. Also the struggle against malaria because likewise the vectors can cross frontiers, as well as the battle against tuberculosis and the battle against sleeping sickness. So peace is an essential element for fighting, not only here but everywhere in the region, against the various diseases which we could avoid if we had the political will and the means to confront them.
Yes, there is a link because there is some population since maybe 5 years or more than that which never see somebody from the health sector visiting them. There are some population hiding in the forest without any assistance. And even in some city, you have hospital, you have clinics, but the economic situation of the families cannot make them go because you have to pay fees. The health care are not, maybe they are available, but the people cannot access due to the lack of money. For me, there is a link. There is a link with between the war and the worsening of the health situation.
Without peace, the chances are that the DRC will remain mired in ever-deteriorating health conditions, with increased epidemics and higher rates of malnutrition. Gro Harlem Brundtland is the Director General of the World Health Organization.
Peace is the highest health priority, because with peace, you can go in with our knowledge base and make a considerable difference to people's lives. If peace is not there, so many barriers are there which we need to reduce, and which is why the two are linked so closely.
With this week's peace talks in Botswana raising hopes of a ceasefire in the conflict, the humanitarian crisis remains. Some observers contend that the international community should be doing much more to support the beleaguered population of the DRC in the current crisis. Bart De Porter is medical coordinator for international NGO Belgian Doctors Without Borders in Kinshasa.
I don't think so they are doing enough at this moment. I mean, if you see the child mortality, things like this, I mean, it's the situation is quite bad at the moment. There should be more donors giving more money to Congo. But it's for sure there's a high mortality. I went into Equateur 1 month ago. I mean, there are villages where they are at 100 kilometers from a health center. So those people, well, they have traditional medicine, that's for sure. But Western medicine, there is none there at the moment. And this gives a high mortality, I mean, that's for sure. Especially at the front lines, there is malnutrition. And it depends also from area to area. It's a huge country, so it's difficult to see the Congo as one. I mean, there are different areas and with problems. So it's for sure people living around the front lines, there is a malnutrition problem. Because, okay, they can't work on the lands, they can't do agriculture, or there's no hunting or no fishing, it's very difficult. So they have less food.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook, in Kinshasa, the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Boulder, Colorado has become the fifth city in America to ban municipal purchase of World Bank bonds. In doing so, the Boulder City Council joined the cities of San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley, California, and Tacoma Park, Maryland, along with 12 unions, 7 religious institutions, and 10 investment firms. The campaign was recently launched in Europe, and there are growing World Bank bonds boycotts initiatives in Australia, Africa, Asia, Central America, and the Caribbean. Activists say the campaign, which modeled on the anti-apartheid divestment movement, is causing the bank serious concern. High-level World Bank officials, they say, attempted to dissuade members of the Boulder Council from passing the resolution by sending several lengthy emails to city officials, including a 12-page position paper. More from Nell Geiser in Boulder.
Boulder, Colorado became the 5th city in the United States to endorse the World Bank bonds boycott on Tuesday night. 80% of the bank's funding comes from privately traded bonds, which have a AAA credit rating and are purchased by cities, universities, pension funds, and other institutions. Part of a nationwide campaign to exert financial pressure on the international financial institution, city councils in San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley, California, Tacoma Park, Maryland, and now Boulder, say they will not buy World Bank bonds until the bank cancels 100% of illegitimate international debts owed to it, ends structural adjustment policies, and stops environmentally destructive projects. The bank's mission is to alleviate poverty, but a growing global justice movement asserts that the bank is in the service of transnational corporations and actually increases poverty around the world. Councilmember Spence Havlick voted to endorse the boycott.
My position was determined by the citizens' concern about inequities, about mismanagement, about increased liabilities on poor countries and poor peoples.
The Boulder resolution passed the city council unanimously, with 4 members absent. The city already had a policy that said it would not purchase World Bank bonds because they are not a stable investment. But the resolution passed Tuesday stipulates that the city will not reconsider buying the bonds until the bank is fundamentally restructured. Some city council members saw the action as overly symbolic and not within their purview. But local activists point to the victory as illustrating the importance of municipalities taking a stand on global issues. Tom Mayer is a sociology professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder.
The World Bank with its structural adjustments program is a major cause of poverty and of environmental destruction and of economic inequality in the world. I am here because I think that the local government is one of the few places where one can oppose the policies put in force by the World Bank, because it's one of the few places where corporate dominance is not so great and one has a chance to have citizen voices heard.
Organizers hope that the World Bank bond boycott, along with mass protests at the World Bank and International Monetary Fund meetings in Washington, D.C. this fall, will force the bank to listen to citizens' voices. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Geiser in Boulder, Colorado.
Millions of Americans tuned in last night to ABC's primetime interview of U.S. Representative Gary Condit and Connie Chung, which means millions more did not. The subject of Condit's relationship to Washington intern Chandra Levy from his home district of Modesto, California, has captured the public's attention to a degree rivaling that of the Clinton-Lewinsky affair and the O.J. Simpson trial. At the same time, millions of other Americans just, quite frankly, don't give a damn. They cite issues like world poverty, the growing hordes of homeless people on streets across America, and the hundreds of thousands of people who turn up missing every year that never get so much as a mention on the nightly news, as topics more worthy of media scrutiny. And who can argue that? Yet some, even many in the progressive community, are intrigued by the case for various reasons. Jeff Cohen is with the New York-based media watch group FAIR, an acronym for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. We thought it would be interesting to get a slightly more progressive take on the massive media coverage of this woman's disappearance. Jeff, the mainstream press has been fixated with this Chandra Levy disappearance for months. Is it, in your opinion, inappropriate to focus so heavily on the disappearance of a single woman when hundreds of people disappear in America every day?
Yeah, I think not only is it inappropriate, it's become downright disgusting in recent days. And it's because the news media in our country are now controlled by entertainment conglomerates, and what they try to do is get us hooked on a soap opera and then pump it for weeks or months on end. So right now it's all Chandra all the time on cable news and other media outlets. It used to be all Monica all the time, or all OJ all the time, or all JFK Jr. crash all the time, or all Princess Diana crash. The fact is that these stories have very little social or political impact. They certainly don't affect millions of people like much other news would. And the one thing these stories do is they keep us on the sidelines as passive spectators watching a media spectacle. We know the characters in a soap opera. We don't know exactly how it's going to come out. The fact is, it's not news.
Now, comedian Jay Leno called the interview primetime slime, and while one has got to admit, I agree with you, there is the purient interest, the soap opera-like quality to all this. At the same time, is there something more? What about the morality of the tone of a U.S. congressman while cheating on his own wife repeatedly?
Well, again, that could be an issue, but why stop at Condit? If you're going to decide, and I don't want to encourage the mainstream media to go down that road, because they'll never turn back. In fact, that's the road they want to go, which is all sex all the time, all sex scandals all the time. I mean, look at Bill Clinton's administration. He did a lot of things that were scandalous in terms of criminal justice and overseas adventures and bombing people that and pharmaceutical factory in Sudan. But in the media, there was only one scandal, and it was his sex life. Now, I would say, Verna, that one issue that may be fair game, but they use these the hypocrisy fig leaf to focus on sex, sex, sex. I mean, Condit is a conservative Democratic politician who has always taken the position, often taken the position, that the federal government should take a stand on private and family morality. He was one of the co-sponsors of the bill that would allow the Ten Commandments to be put in classrooms at public schools. He was, you know, he voted for the initiation of impeachment hearings over Clinton, and he called Clinton, you know.
He also called for full disclosure on the part of Clinton.
Yes, he wanted the Starr report disclosed. Release it all, he said. Everything.
Which is something he doesn't seem to be willing to do.
Again, there is an issue of hypocrisy, but it would be more about, if I were a journalist interviewing him, I would want to focus on the public policy hypocrisy. I don't want to go down the route of sex lives of public figures, because trust me, with the entertainment conglomerates owning the news, that's all we would hear about.
I get the feeling also with this particular case, Jeff, that much of the interest has to do with wanting a person in power to be held accountable for his actions.
Yeah, I think
there's a sense that even though he is a U.S. congressman, he can't be above the law, and most importantly, should not be involved or allowed to get away with murder if, and I underscore that, if
right,
in fact he had some involvement in Ms. Leavy's disappearance.
Right, except I think that many of these reporters that are going after Condit do not in any way believe he was involved in the disappearance. That's just their fig leaf by which they can talk about sex. And it's this phony populism. I can only think how many times the day of the Connie Chung interview I heard Condit referred to as the most detested man in America. And the media have made him the most detested man in America. And I know I was in Detroit, Michigan this weekend. I read a conservative daily. They had a front page story about how people were leaving Michigan to go to Canada because the cancer drugs in Michigan cost 10 times as much as they do in Canada. Now, if reporters for months focused on the pharmaceutical executives who were responsible for that ripoff of American consumers and working class people across the country, I think that those pharmaceutical executives might be deemed even more detestable than Gary Condit here. The fact is that this is a major distraction. I like to think of the media outlets controlled by these giant conglomerates. They are basically weapons of mass distraction at this point.
Jeff Cohen of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.